Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, the environment, science, policy, and activism. And every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your well-being, the well-being of your community, and all of the different things going on in our society and on the earth that impact all of us on both individual, community, and collective levels. Each week on Connect the Dots, I host different authors, activists, experts, scientists, filmmakers, and a whole host of other people who are bringing into the light different things that we need to know about in order to create a healthier society and respect and love and support our habitat here, planet Earth. And so that's what we do each week on the show. And actually, I think this is our fifth year is completing, and we're going into our sixth year this very month on the Progressive Radio Network. Today, I'm really delighted to have a guest. She is an author, an activist. She actually fits into multiple of the categories that I was just mentioning. Her name is Rivera Sun. We're going to be discussing her new novel, The Way Between, which is it's like a fable, a myth, and also in its own way a template for action and guidance, something that we need more than ever before. Rivera has written other books. Her most prominently well-known one is The Dandelion Insurrection. She's very interested in nonviolent resistance and all of the tools that we're going to need and ways of being and of changing our being, our way of functioning or understanding that we're going to be needing in the times ahead and that we've needed in the times past as well. There's the Dandelion Insurrection also has a study guide. She'll be talking more about that too on the show because people can actually learn how to do and act and organize and get together with others in the most effective ways, and that's what we'll be talking about today. I have been following Rivera's work for a while and just so happy to have you joining us here on Connect the Dots today. Welcome, Rivera.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Allison. It's a real honor and a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, it's really, as we were talking about a little bit before we went on air here, I very rarely feature works of fiction of any kind because actually I find that a lot of modern fiction doesn't appeal to me all that much because it's sort of around sort of a lot of minor personality and relationships concerns of privileged people and, you know, or it's escapist or something like that. It's not that we don't sometimes need to, kind of shift our focus and look in, broaden our scope and look in another direction. But I often don't find that, contemporary fiction, unless it's, Native American fiction, for example, does that very much. But I really loved your book, The Way Between, because it kind of opens the way to the mythic and the practical and gives us, takes us into another world and really gives us another view of how to approach. And, we often say we're learning lessons in life. The question is, what lessons are we learning? Merely going through pain and struggle without getting to the right answers we need for our world, it may be a lesson learned, but it may not be as helpful a lesson as, that really helps us step up to help preserve and protect each other and, kind of humanize our functioning in our world in the ways that your book models. You also organize workshops. You've also written other books that are not novels. What is the difference in your mind between what you seek to do in writing a novel like The Way Between and, what and how that interfaces is with some of the other practical guidance for warriorship, which is a, you know, kind of open-hearted warriorship, which is the theme of all your books. Is, you know, that's my take on it, and you can, you know, take it in another direction if it's something else really speaks better to you.
Well, I think all of my books are really about taking the values that we have learned to honor in terms of warriors, the courage, the valor, the solidarity, the protecting of one another, and relating them to the tools of nonviolent action and active peace building that we are finding in modern contemporary times, that these tools of nonviolent action are actually twice as effective as nonviolent tools, that, as violent tools, so we're finding in struggles around the world that people who choose nonviolence are succeeding twice as often as parallel struggles that choose violence as their means of struggle. That's a new finding that has just come out in the past few years that is groundbreaking and astonishing to all of us, and actually requires everyone, no matter what role you play in society, to really reevaluate and assess what we're promoting. As someone who writes novels, for me, that question comes down to what is the plot line? What is the story? What is the narrative that I am promoting? Now, it's not just that nonviolence is, you know, arguably more moralistic than violence. It's that it's actually more effective. And so when our children are reading The Hunger Games, or when we ourselves are only watching Star Wars-esque movies, we're learning all those values that I mentioned that we all prize, the courage and the valor, the protection, but we're actually learning a mechanism of struggle that has been demonstrated to not be as effective as its nonviolent alternative. And this comes as a surprise to many people. But see, nonviolent action and peace building is a wide, broad, and deep field that goes far beyond simply protesting or turning the other cheek, and goes into forms of non-cooperation, direct intervention, using the 198 methods that are available to us of boycotts, strikes, sit-ins, occupations, blockades, sit-ins, shutdowns, and so many more, to actually create a condition under which tyranny, oppression, and injustice can no longer operate within our society, that it simply cannot continue on its devastating path. And this has been shown to be very effective. So as a novelist, I try to weave this knowledge into the plot lines. The Dandelion Insurrection, as you mentioned, is a story about a nonviolent struggle in a slightly fictionalized United States just around the corner of today. After I wrote that novel, I had many people asking me, would it be good for children? And while it's been taught in high schools and been shared with youth leadership conferences and has really done a lot of great work in the teenager to college age levels and up through the rest of humanity, it's a little bit older and more mature than, say, your 8, 9, or 10-year-old. And yet our 8, 9, and 10-year-olds love fiction, they love fantasy, they love action, they love adventure, and most of those stories are based on sword swinging and battles and violence and training as knights and the kind of warriors that use violence. So with the way between, I set out to give them an alternative. I have a niece and a nephew who are getting to be about that age, and I thought, what are they going to read that's going to teach them the third option between fight and flight? That we have another option, and that is active nonviolence. And so The Way Between is a story of a young girl in a slightly fictionalized world, or a fantasy world, who is chosen to learn a secret way between, something that has been forgotten by her warrior society, but gives you that third option. And she trains in it like a martial arts, a physical form. And she trains in it as a inner form of philosophy and way of being in the world. And she trains in it as a form of conflict resolution. And there's a whole arc and plot and adventure and secrets and mystery and adventure and unexpected surprises that go along with it. And it supplies all those things that we love about those kind of stories, but with a framework that is actually preparing ourselves and our children for the world that's emerging around us. Although we see so much violence, we often don't see the incredible rise of active nonviolence in the world.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, one of the things that's been striking me is, you know, we're just coming out of a campaign, you know, an election that has been extremely divisive in our country. And, you know, not only in the traditional way that people would think about that with, you know, the Democrats over here and the Republicans over there. Actually, there's a lot of movement between the parties and people who fall into a gap between them that don't identify with either. And, you know, and yet there's been a tremendous amount of division, and even people who agree on basic civil rights and civil liberties values as being vitally important, which would characterize all the people on the liberal end of the spectrum, you know, are not in agreement as to tactics, priorities. You know, they weren't in agreement about candidates. And now as we move forward during a time where, you know, there will be very likely additional challenges because of, you know, in a time where we're seeking to also, you know, stall, slow, address the acceleration of climate change through the fossil fuel use that people deploy to get energy. And I'm noting that, you know, you live very close to the earth and everything in your way of life. But, you know, how can, you know, right now there just seems to be a lot of, just even on the liberal side of the spectrum, a lot of disagreement, different perspectives, arguments, conflicts, seeing reality in different ways. What does the nonviolent approach have to bring to that kind of dialogue so that people who are, you know, maybe close in certain values and yet not entirely on the same page can overcome their differences or find ways to join together on, you know, and really take action together on some of the values that they share.
Well, there's a couple of thoughts that come to mind. One is a basic approach to differences, which my opinion on this is rooted more in democracy than in nonviolence, but for a real direct participatory democracy, I think nonviolence is very deeply woven into that, and vice versa, that the best kind of nonviolence and nonviolent movements are very democratic. So what I think about and what I have been thinking deeply about in 2016 and as we move forward from the elections and into this time of organizing, mobilizing, resisting injustice, is that if we want to have democracy in this country, it does not mean that we are all going to agree. It does not mean that we're all going to see these things the same way. It means that we're going to develop a set of skills and tools and approaches for respecting and honoring our differences, hearing each other, listening to one another, discourse and dialogue, which are the foundation of democracy, and which is one of the reasons why we do not have a functional democracy in this country, is that we have forgotten the skills of discourse and dialogue, and we have fallen into argument and shouting, which is very convenient for the ruling class on both the left and the right to have the rest of us bound up in our intolerance and hatred of one another and our inability to actually have a conversation together. So I think one of the things that I myself am practicing is this kind of listening that starts with respecting the other person, even if we have a long history of disagreeing or a long history of injustice between us, whether I myself have been perpetrating that or whether I've been receiving that, that we don't resolve these problems without the initial starting ground of change beginning in a place of honoring the dignity and respect of all human beings. So I have been really thinking about what is the personal approach to peace building in our communities. How did we get to this place as Americans? What are these divisions and separations that have kept us apart? And how do I, stage by stage, step by step, start to approach that? Now, a lot of these skills can be described as nonviolent conflict resolution, which is a field of itself, and your listeners can Google it and look it up and learn all the different components and dimensions. There are lots of skills and practices that go along with that are very helpful, including group processes or how to have a conversation or how to de-escalate violent conflict situations into a place of listening, compassion, and respect. Or at least listening and tolerance so that we can deal with our conflict in a way that is not escalating into violence. So beyond that, when we are, let's look a little bit at the left for a moment. If we are facing major divisions, we are facing major scars and wounds that we've inflicted on one another through the course of the past year. And we're facing major challenges ahead. And so one of the approaches I think we could take to this is to agree to disagree and to use a movement-of-movement style approach. I like to liken this as like when birds flock in the sky and move and shift and change shape and dimension and split and branch off and then reform and form a whole flock again, or then circle around to do a different tact or different approach, that we can achieve a fluid unity and diversity. We do not need to have a monolithic unity to achieve the goals that we're trying to achieve. But we do need to, I think one of the things that would help us is to stop expecting everyone to get in line and goose step and pretend that we're all the same and that we're going to agree on everything. But rather, when we see a campaign that we can support, to get involved and to help it. And if that particular organization that is organizing that goes into another campaign that we disagree with, then don't support it. That we're in our movements ourselves, we are learning to express embodied democracy, the choice to show up, the choice not to show up. And this is why nonviolence is important. Nonviolence is really rooted as a tool of social political change in our giving of consent or our withholding of consent, our giving of our cooperation to the systems and structures that proliferate in our world, or our withholding of that consent and cooperation. And this is true for the positive, all the good things we want to see in the world, and all of the negative. But there is no option for passivity in this system. In this kind of reality that we live in, which is a living systems reality, our actions matter, our thoughts, our words, our speech, the way we show up in the world matters. Where we put our actions makes a difference. And so we have so much agency and we have so much untapped potential and agency. And I think that this is the time for us as humanity to really embrace that embodied democracy and the tools of nonviolence as a means to the ends of that embodied democracy. And I think that we will see that if we can manage this within our movements, we can manage this on our broader social political field, and it itself becomes the healing process by which the right and the left learn to respect and communicate with one another, and with which the populace can quite possibly find a way to address the long-standing injustices that we know are wrong in the world.
Thank you. That's a beautiful answer. That really makes a lot of sense. So it's like we don't have to agree on everything. We have to, gravitate to the things that have value for us and participate, and listen to each other are some of the takeaways that that I'm getting from what you have just shared. Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense, really. But we're really coming off of a time where there's been a lot of criticism, a lot of castigation, a lot of, and this is from my perspective as a journalist and someone in the media for many years, a lot of misleading, confusing spins of various kinds. I mean, one that immediately comes to mind is when the younger generation, millennial people who were for Bernie Sanders, whether male or female, were characterized by the name Bernie Bro. Another, you know, recent one is that now there's immediately following the election, there became, you know, a phrase, fake news. And so these kinds of phrases that are put out in the media become things that shape our beliefs and that people constellate around and actually adopt that, you know, kind of define, judge, or limit our ability to perceive broader options in reality. So that's another one of my particular hobby horses, because I see that happening. You know, I see these memes put out there, and then I hear friends who are, environmental leaders or feminists, you know, deriding younger people as, you know, as if they were kind of mean-spirited, you know, kind of hoodish, you know, younger men or something, you know. So we kind of adopt a lot of these sort of negative judgments through all of this languaging and wanting to kind of be with the program and buy into what leaders or heroes that we have, you know, kind of how they're defining things or what they're putting out there and telling us is, you know, is happening. And then, you know, in my perception, that really limits our ability to get a broader view if we regard all of the people in the Rust Belt as bigots, you know, if we, you know, I mean, it goes on and on. There's a lot of this is out and about. What do you recommend that people do to maintain a kind of broader and more expanded sense rather than kind of honing down into judgments and polarizing?
Wow, you know, I've been termed a radical for years and years and years now, and one of the things that I always keep in mind when people throw a label at me is that every human being, every self-respecting person has a right to the critique of their own thoughts. You know, so the Buddha said, don't believe me, go find out for yourself. And that I think that is such good advice for these times that we're in. I think that we should be very, not critical, maybe critical in the old-fashioned sense of the word, not criticizing, but rather using our critical capacity to discern or to question or to think about things deeply, to not jump on bandwagons, but rather to walk our own path. To support things that we believe in, but then to be able to dissent from that which we think is wrong, even if it's pillorying a person that we think has done wrong, but we don't agree with the pillorying of people. I think that we as a populace, the U.S., we have a lot more capacity for individual dissent, not individualization, because individualization in the United States is basically mass consumerism and falling in line with a status quo that is majorly homogenized, but rather to have individual thought or to really think deeply and come to our own conclusions. I spent a year on the road touring with the Dandelion Insurrection and teaching nonviolent struggle in small towns and communities all across the United States. And I went into the Midwest, and I went into the Rust Belt, and I went into the South, and I went into the Northeast and the Pacific Northwest and California and the deserts. I mean, I went everywhere. And what I can tell you is that I still love Americans. I mean, we are so crazy in so many ways. And yes, there are bigots and racists and people who are xenophobic. And yes, there are amazing people in every community defying every label and convention any of us from either side of the aisle would want to put on each other. And so One of the dynamics that is noted in nonviolent struggle or in conflict in general is that if you want to go to war, if you want to do violence, and this comes out of the military who have really thought, the U.S. military, who have really thought deeply about how do we get people who do not naturally want to become killers to go and kill other people. How do we get them to kill? Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to dehumanize another human being, the enemy. You have to make them into non-humans. And we've seen this in every propaganda routine around wars since the creation of war. It's just gotten better as time has gone on. I won't repeat the slurs that we all know have gone along with the people that we have made war upon. But the converse is true of nonviolent struggle. That if you want to resolve a conflict nonviolently, the best thing you can do is start to humanize everyone in the equation. Yourselves as movement, your opposition, the bystanders, the whole of humanity, and raise up the reality that we are human beings together. So I think in the United States, as we are facing these major divisions, these animosities, these scars that we are holding, the uncertainty of our future ahead, we need to, each of us, I'm not talking about a mass movement or a big media campaign, but each of us individually can do one thing to help repair the rift in this country, and that is to really humanize every person that we are feeling the compulsion to speak about. Whether it is a politician, which I admit is very challenging for me, we have some challenging characters in that political scene, or whether it is, you know, those people in the Rust Belt, or those people down in the South, or the conservatives, or the liberals, but rather to think of them as those mothers and fathers, those children, those young people, those older people, but even more than that, to try to conjure up a face to put upon them. And then think about how your words might change. So at the very least, that's a place to start. And beyond that, I really do recommend trying to get outside of our silos of bubbles and actually talk with people who we don't agree with, and to really have a conversation that involves listening rather than shouting and arguing. So I have found that it's very informative. I have found it's very healing. I have found that it's not an easy process, but it is very necessary.
What do you, I mean, in your own work, I have studied and trained many years back, and I haven't kept up with it, but if I am in, you know, an incredibly immediate conflictual circumstance, you know, I will fall back on it. The nonviolent communication techniques of Marshall Rosenberg, but, you know, sometimes it's kind of, you know, sometimes that works, sometimes it's easier said than done. That's a bit formulaic. If you could give our listeners, you know, and you feel yourself kind of chafing up. I mean, I did it with someone on my Facebook page this week. I've been posting a lot of information about the lack of substantial sourcing evidence for the allegations that Russia, the Russians had somehow interfered with and determined the outcome of our election. Obviously, if that were true, it would be tremendously concerning, but in fact, there were just rumors and no substantive evidence. And I, remembering, you know, the Red Scare and the Cold War, and also are going into the Iraq War based on allegations, you know, was not happy, especially to see liberals and left-leaning people engaging in this kind of pointing the finger other at the horror of the Russians and Putin, especially in the absence of evidence. So I've been posting a lot about that. Somebody posted a piece basically laying out the dangers of Russia and what Putin's plan is and all of that. True or not, one person's perspective, still no actual grounded proof of any active interference in flipping votes in the United States in the election. Nevertheless, it created a narrative or a story about why this might be happening. So when one of my sort of dissenting Facebook friends posted this on my page, I had to kind of go and do all this due diligence to say, who has written this? Why is it suddenly everywhere? And, of course, you know, it's somebody with a specific kind of agenda, as it turns out. I found myself getting really angry with the person who posted it. They were just sharing information, but they frequently argue or dissent from what I'm posting because I felt called upon to do all this research and take all this time away from things like, you know, my own writing, reading your book, or, you know, whatever, in order to have this dialogue. And I kind of said, you know, next time, you know, tag me, and if I decide to post it, I will. And, you know, I'd appreciate your learning the skills that I keep modeling and doing your own research. And then I thought, well, that was kind of harsh. You know, part of why people turn to somebody like me is because they trust me, or they're trying to educate me, or, you know, because they don't agree with me or whatever. So, you know, really that is part of the dialogue. But then it just in that moment, it was kind of like a bridge too far. And I was sort of scolding the person, and I kind of felt I felt badly about it afterward. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when it goes into these online exchanges, you know, what I mean, I guess I'm bringing that up to ask, what are good rules of the road? Because on the one hand, we're agreeing with people that already agree with us, and we're going, thank you, you know, thank you, I agree. Or else if somebody comes along, which are the very people we're kind of hoping to educate or have a dialogue with, and they present a dissenting view, you know, the tendency is to get kind of fired up and you know, and refute them, and we're in a debate, you know. Do you have another better kind of model for how we could think about that, those kinds of exchanges?
Well, I love that you bring it up because I, at one point, I realized that a lot of our, you know, we don't live in a democracy. I always like to say that, but a lot of our democratic society process, the part of discourse, is happening in Facebook comment threads or tweets back and forth, which is, you know, it's better than nothing, but it's a little bit limited. Although I really enjoy social media. I've learned a lot, and I've met a lot of people, and I've had a lot of exchanges. I've had my own heart opened. I've opened other hearts through it. One of the things that I have found to be very effective for both myself and others on comment threads is to use a written version of the Clara method or the C-Lara method, which involves, it's similar to nonviolent communication, but the basic process is center yourself first. That's the C, center yourself. Take a breath. I mean, thank goodness you're on Facebook and not in the supermarket, right? otherwise, you might just lose your temper. I know I might. Then listen. Listen deeply. Read that comment again. This is if you have time. If you're feeling rushed or if you're feeling like you have to go create something beautiful in the world and you can't take the you don't want to take the time away from the good work you're doing to deal with this, don't. Do what you need to do, basically. But if you're going to take the time to respond, one of the mechanisms I use is this center. Listen to the other person deeply. Affirm what they're saying. You don't have to agree with it, but affirm it in some way. Acknowledge that you have heard it in a way that makes them understand that you have listened. Usually I say something like, I find your point about such and such really interesting. I hadn't looked at it from that perspective or something to that effect. It's better if you don't use a formula, but you really think about this as an embodied process. Once you've affirmed, you might have to repeat that a couple times to the person if they're really agitated. These are skills that we use in street demonstrations that I also use online. But if you get to a place where you feel like you and the other person are listening to each other, you can then respond. And then you can add something new to the equation. Usually when you get to that point, what you've established is that you and the other person have heard and recognized and seen each other's basic human dignity. You're not in a dehumanized fight or attack with one another. You're dealing with each other as humans. You're having a discourse and dialogue. It might unfold over time. You don't have to necessarily agree, because the that primal thing of I need my safety and security assured has been acknowledged. And I found that's hugely important in when people are really worked up, both in person and online. So that's one of my kind of tools that I've been trying to practice with. And also to remember that it's not about winning. I host a radio show called Love and Revolution Radio, which covers some of the very similar things to your show, Allison. But my co-host, Sherry Mitchell, who is Penobscot Indigenous from Maine, she likes to challenge those of us who are involved in nonviolent movements to not use nonviolence as another form of conquest ideology. That it's not about overthrowing the beliefs or the injustices that we don't agree with. It's about the fact that we have a conflict in our society, and that to come to a new solution, a just solution, is going to require change. So there's an approach in our attitudes that is very much based in conquest ideology. I have to be right and you have to be wrong, and I have to prove that you're wrong. And we can drop that. It's okay if there are multiple formations of rights going on in our conversations. It's okay if we hold conflicting worldviews. We do need to stand up to the injustices that we perceive, and that's why in nonviolence we really have what we call the two hands of nonviolence. This is a framework conceived of by the civil rights activist and feminist Barbara Deming, who said the first hand of injustice says, I will stop the harm caused by your injustice. But the other hand of injustice, the other hand of nonviolence says that I am still open to you as a person. We can also frame this as standing against the injustice or standing for the solution at the same time. So those are some thoughts. And I think the more we practice our nonviolent conflict resolution skills in our conversations on Facebook, in our novels, if we're novelists, wherever it might show up, the more chances we have of avoiding a civil war, avoiding violent unrest, avoiding hate crimes, avoiding acts of violence, avoiding gang, not just gang, I was thinking about lynch mobs as a form of gang violence, particularly white supremacist lynch mobs are coming to mind. But we stand a better chance of avoiding all forms of violence within our society if we can actually implement these tools and skills of nonviolence in increments in our lives in different places.
If you had a crystal ball looking ahead at what you see as some of the major challenges that could be coming at us that these tools could help with, that we should be prepared for. Part of the thing right now is I think we're facing a tremendous unknown. There's a lot of fear and concern about it. There are certainly many reasons for that. I would never say to anyone, don't be afraid or something. I think it's going to be that's going to be suppressive to some people's natural reaction. At the same time, if you become hysterical and desperate, grasping, at anything, it can also be very non-strategic. It can be counterproductive. If you had a crystal ball, what do you see coming down the line, and where do you see our entree points and also how we maintain ourselves and stay centered through what is coming, what may be coming toward us?
Well, I think I see two things. One, we see both systemic and societal rising injustice, and I'll say more about that in a moment. But we're also going to see rising resistance massively in ways that those of us who are millennials, like myself, I'm as old as you can be and still be a millennial, have actually never seen before in our lifetimes. And it's going to be surprising who will be rising up, because the scope of the injustices that are foreshadowed by the beliefs and the policies of those who are coming into power will strike across a cross-section of people who have not traditionally been mobilized into movements yet, but will be because of the challenges that we are facing. So I think what we will see, unfortunately, is the plundering of America. I have a deep concern about that in terms of the cabinet picks of the Trump administration, the ideologies and beliefs of the Republican-controlled Congress, and a few other reasons because of that. It is not a purely Republican problem and should not be framed only as a Republican problem. The Democrats have also had their hand in this, but we are going to see, I suspect we are going to see the privatization of anything possible and the need for resisting that privatization. That's where I think we will see school teachers and nurses and civil servants who are already mobilizing, actually, and Social Security recipients and veterans moving more and more and more in greater numbers into action. And I think, and I hope, this is my prayer, that we will learn increasingly to stand in solidarity with one another, that we will recognize the commonalities within our struggles, even as we understand that there are differences, and that this will help to create a consensus among the populace about who we are and what we stand for. Now, one of the things I hope we do not do as a populace is the kind of organizing that likes to scapegoat. We on the left are opposing that when we see it coming from the right, particularly around immigration, that is immigration or Islamophobia, the right is tending to scapegoat some major structural and societal and economic issues on particular segments of our population. We oppose that. And yet we are not as good at challenging ourselves to move beyond our own scapegoating that we do while pointing fingers at the right. This is incredibly divisive, and I think it is part of the long-term issue that underlies why we have such an opposed populace and such a siloed populace that doesn't understand the viewpoints of one another. So my hope, and I suspect we will see a degree of this, is that we will see the waves of social, political, economic movements creating a back and forth, a tidal wave in and out of dialogue across the aisle, where we will have to confront and rise up and look at truth, and we will have to confront and rise up and look at injustice and look at history and look at current events. And I don't think it's going to be easy. I think it's going to be messy. But I think we can organize in ways that do center us, that ground us, that connect us to our hearts. We have seen it in Standing Rock. We have seen it in many of the numerous movements that have risen up in the past few years, that when we connect to our hearts and we humanize one another, there is a tremendously powerful beauty and a tremendously powerful force for change that is unleashed that I think is holds a lot of potential for us at this time.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. That is, I think that encompasses both, you know, the concerns as well as, you know, how we can deal with them. Now, let me just ask you how our listeners can connect with your writings, and if you could talk about, you know, your books and your workshops and, you know, how people who maybe want to learn some of these techniques or read, you know, your books, how they can find them and what the different books cover.
Great. Well, a great like one-stop shop for finding out all about me is my website, www.riverasun, that's S-U-N, like the sun overhead, www.alisonrosleevianum.com, and you will find my books there. Also, more information about my workshops, and we'll soon post upcoming workshops happening at the end of January, beginning of February. Mm-hmm. My novels are all term social protest novels, and they're also all very enjoyable. The first one is Steam Drills, which deals with coal and climate change. The second one is Dandelion Insurrection, which we've spoken about. The third one is Billionaire Buddha, which deals with income and wealth inequality and tells a slightly fictionalized story of a true story of a man who was a member of the 0.01% and chose to give it all away. It's an amazing story, a great radio interview if anyone wants to interview the man who inspired the true story. It's mm-hmm. a truly incredible inside look at who and what the 1% is and why we should be working for greater equality. Mm-hmm. And my newest book, The Way Between, we've just gone through the community publishing process for getting the launch of the book ready to go. So we're in a bit of a dark period. But if anyone absolutely has to have a book, you can email me at rivera@riverasun.com, and we'll make sure we connect you to one. The official first edition release of this will be coming out as soon as possible. And we know that's going to be pretty soon because people do love the book, and we do want to make sure that people can get it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's actually, you know, for us to internalize different models of how to act and to kind of enter a more primal world, you know, which is always kind of there at the essence of who we are. But we have, you know, all of this very distracting the kind of artificial world of our current civilization, you know, kind of before us. And, you know, so it's hard to get and internalize different models and visions if you were not so fortunate as to have them in your immediate family. Some of us do, but, you know, not everybody does. And if you kind of fall into the contemporary culture and just get fixated on it, you know, it's narrow in terms of its options and its models. And I think, you know, many people sense, you know, or know from childhood interactions with grandma or experiences with being in nature with animals, you know, various kinds of things that, you know, there's a whole other way. And, you know, so your book, The Way Between, you know, kind of gives another terrain for the psyche, you know, the soul to kind of roam in and pick up other sorts of possibilities and just kind of begin to, you know, dream of other ways that all of this could be and is going on simultaneously with the sort of the slick show that's put out for us to consume. So, you know, I thank you. How do you come up with the, you know, the ideas for your novels? I mean, does it kind of come to you in a dream or, you know, like how does it evolve that you, you know, when you write a book like the ones that you do?
Well, I'm usually very intentional about it. I look at the problems mm-hmm. that we're facing, and just as you were describing, I try to write a story that allows our minds to go to a place that we haven't been yet as a culture or as individuals in terms of how to address that problem. Because I really mm-hmm. feel like stories are such a deep part of being human that there's a famous quote by someone who I'm forgetting the name of, unfortunately, which says, "The world is made of stories." And we really mm-hmm. do. We tell ourselves these stories from birth to death and from waking mm-hmm. to waking thoughts to sleeping dreams. And mm-hmm. the stories that we tell ourselves are the way we shape our culture and humanity. And so I really think it's time for some very different stories, that many of the stories that we have are built on the kind of stories we needed to invade and conquer, especially if we're coming out of a European-dominated culture, which many of us in the U.S., at least 51% of the populace, pretty much still is. And so we need to unravel those stories that brought us to this point, but have left us with a legacy that is very painful and very violent and very dysfunctional for a world that now has 7.2 billion people on it. That we need stories that teach us how to live together and how to live with our differences and how to respect one another, not how to conquer one another. So I think as someone who is engaged in the field of writing, it is my job to really think about these problems deeply and to tell a story in a way that is captivating, enjoyable, something that we enjoy the experience of learning through. Because when we think about, say, Star Wars or the Odyssey or the Iliad, which maybe in contemporary times we don't think of those as particularly enjoyable, but at one time they were very popular myths, that these were stories that we loved to hear over and over again, and they created our framework of responding to our contemporary problems. Well, I want to see our culture get to the point where the way between is the story that we hear over and over again, or the dandelion insurrection, and that when we need an idea by which to respond to a problem we're facing in our world, we reach for something that we've read about in these stories, or even better, we reach for the stories from the field of nonviolent struggle that have given rise to these novels. So I think that we really, if people, like you asked, where do I get my ideas from? Part of it is the problem, and I guess the part of it is the solution, that I get so many ideas from just paying attention to what people are doing with nonviolent action. It's amazing. It's absolutely incredible what's happening around the world, and I can't tell you how many email listservs I'm on, but how much they hearten me and give me hope and really ground me for these times. I feel that's a big difference between my own perspective and what a lot of people feel when they're looking at the problems that we're facing, is that for every problem we face, I've already heard of a group of people who have faced a similar problem and dealt with it nonviolently. Usually multiple examples of it. And so this is incredibly useful. And I just sit around and imagine sometimes, what would it be like if 320 million Americans all had this perspective? When they were like, they're attempting to privatize our Social Security. We don't like that. Well, when they tried to do this in Iceland, or when they tried to do this in Norway, or when they tried to do this in such and such country, here's what they did. We wouldn't feel so lonely. It wouldn't feel so afraid. We'd have these stories at our fingertips. We'd know how, you know, we keep comparing the regime that's coming into power in the U.S. To the Nazi regime. Well, if we all knew how the Norwegians, for example, resisted the fascist education program of the Nazi occupation government when they took over Norway, we would not understand exactly how we could resist the privatization of our schools. We have the tools from which to extrapolate how to meet the demands of our own situation. So never underestimate the power of a story, both fictional and factual. And know your stories, because I think we're going to need them.
Wow, thank you. That's fantastic. That is, you know, it's really interesting, because what you're talking about are stories as models for action that give hope, that give possibility, and that suggest different ways to intercede and kind of enrich our repertoire to be able to do that. There's also just, you know, part of what's also overwhelming, I think, for people is both, you know, a lack of models and tools such as, you're describing, but also the sense that our particular culture is so monolithic and the one that everyone is kind of hypnotized into and the only possible one. And so reading any kind of story from a different culture, a different perspective, a different time and place can really also loosen that sense of stranglehold, you know, that we're all kind of trapped in this one culture that is maybe lacking in caring or solutions that we need for these times. I mean, I remember, this is bringing back to me, that as a child, somehow or other, happened into our home, a little slim, pale green volume of Japanese folk tales. I read that book, I don't know how many times, because it represented a different cultural perspective. They ate different fruit, they acted in different ways, they held different values, you know, and instead of fearing the other, actually, I would also like to offer the prescription that we reach out to get it, you know, inside the skin and the feeling and the perspective of the other, and, you know, kind of broaden from what we know now and, you know, become like someone who eats a diverse diet of many different nourishing things, you know, rather than eating a mono diet of one thing only. And so, you know, so I'm just popping up with that one here, inspired by what you've been saying. Because, you know, we get so, as Americans, you know, we think we're so important that we have it all figured out and that our culture is the greatest in the world, the only one that's ever existed, and the only option for understanding. And I love all these listservs that you're on, how you translate that into your own writing and teaching. You know, I just want to thank you so much for all that you're doing and also for joining me and our listeners today on Connect the Dots. We have been talking with Rivera Sun, the author of The Way Between and The Dandelion Insurrection. You can find her work online at www.riverasun.com. What a beautiful name, because it's kind of got the river and the sun, you know, in it. Really lovely. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for being on the airwaves week after week with these important stories that help us find the heart of change right in ourselves.
Yes, it is. I adore it, actually. It's a great pleasure, and I just learned so much from people like you and, you know, everyone who comes on the show. It's just been fantastic, and it's, you know, and our listeners do too. So thank you, listeners, for being with us again this week on Connect the Dots. We'll be back with you next week again at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Meanwhile, Happy New Year. This is our first show in the new year of 2017. Pick up The Way Between when it's available, and be well.
And the snake was there.